Hello everyone, my name is Reese Garlinski and this is Young History, episode 160 on Sudan. Now the capital of Sudan is Khartoum. The name Sudan actually comes from the Arabic term Bilad al-Sudan, which means land of the blacks. This is also very accurate because statistically some of the darkest people in the world actually come from Sudan because of the fact that it is in that sub-Saharan region where there's a lot of sun. So, and obviously we've talked about this before throughout parts of the podcast. The only reason race exists at all is because of where different people ended up. People where it was cold stayed inside and made fur things to wear, so ended up looking kind of white. And people who were in the sun for hundreds of thousands of years ended up dark. So, not to give you guys a full argument against eugenics here, but little taste of it for you, because anytime we get to countries like this, I like to say a little thing to be cheeky, because it's annoying as fuck when people are sassy about race. Nonetheless, I'm going to give you guys some facts, and then we'll keep going. So, Sudan has many great festivals that represent its different people groups with the great culture it shows. Some of these festivals are the Sufi Holiya Festival that happens in Khartoum. There's also the Khartoum International Musical Festival and the Albuga International Theater Festival. All of these are very big for Sudan because it's one of the most diverse nations in the world. It has about 600 ethnic groups, and there's a lot of fluidity within the ethnic groups. Including that is that 70% of the population is considered Sudanese Arab. The majority is made up of black ethnic groups like the Beja, Nuba, Fur, and other groups. And then on top of that, the nation is about 97% Muslim in practice and is a Sunni majority within it. And then some other facts are that sandalwood is widely grown in Sudan because it is one of the most expensive woods in the world. And Sudan is the number one producer of sesame seeds worldwide. It produces 80% of the world's gum arabic. And gum arabic, if you don't know, is a rubbery kind of gummy thing that comes from acacia trees and is used in food products, glue, and incense. So it's in very high demand across the world. And that gets us to the end of the intro. I don't want to dilly-dally anymore. I want to get right into Sudan's history because there's a lot to sort through. So I'm very glad you guys are here. And one more time, my name is Reese Garlinski. This is Young History. And this nation is Sudan. Hope you guys enjoy. Our origins begin with the Jebel Sahaba remains, which come from Sudan. These are dated back to over 350,000 years ago, which make them possibly the oldest remains in the world. Then from here, we make a huge jump to when there's some more archaeological evidence of people. That's with the A group culture. It existed between 380 BC and 3100 BC. This was a group that recorded agricultural practice, cultural celebrations, and more on stone tablets and pottery. This group lasted until the first dynasty of Egypt in the north, and it was encapsulated into Egypt under the name Nubia. The different people of the lands became the Nubians. They were a combination of the people groups in the area that lived in very similar conditions because of Egyptian rule. One of the first Nubian entities was the Kerma Kingdom. The kingdom lasted from 2500 BC to 1500 BC. The Kerma Kingdom was one of the earliest complex societies to emerge in the Nile River Valley. It is believed to have originated as a series of small agricultural communities along the Nile River. They gradually coalesced into a centralized state around 2500 BC. The capital of the Kerma Kingdom was the city of Kerma, located on the eastern bank of the Nile River. The economy of the kingdom was based primarily on agriculture, with fertile food plains of the Nile River supporting the cultivation of crops such as wheat, barley, and sorghum. The Kerma Kingdom developed a rich cultural and religious tradition, characterized by monumental architecture, elaborate burial practices, and intricate pottery and artwork. The Kerma Kingdom had close cultural and economic ties with ancient Egypt, which influenced its language, religion, and material culture. However, the relationship between the two kingdoms was often characterized by rivalry and conflict. This was mainly because they competed for control over the trade routes of the Nile River. In 1500 BC, the Kerma Kingdom was conquered by the New Kingdom of Egypt. Egyptian rule saw cultural influence come from Egypt as well as its different customs. Egyptians controlled the land for hundreds of years and faced a lot of Nubian uprisings. The Nubians were very discontent with the way they were being ruled by the Egyptians because they were such a strong culture in and of themselves. None of the rebellious movements that happened ever succeeded. Then there was also a resentment that grew between the Nubians and Egyptians because of how they had treated each other. However, around 1000 BC, the New Kingdom of Egypt began to decline, and there was a shift in Nubia. The period from 1077 BC to 644 BC is known as the Intermediate Period, the Third Intermediate Period to be specific. During this period, the Nubians would form the Kingdom of Kush. The Kushite heartland was within the borders of modern-day Sudan. The Kingdom of Kush lasted from 780 BC to 350 CE. At one point, Kush became so powerful that it was able to conquer Egypt. The Kushites became pharaohs in the 25th dynasty of Egypt. The Kushites had similar customs to the Egyptians because of the thousands of years of influence that the first kingdom of Egypt thrust onto Nubia, and this is why the Nubian Kushites actually left behind pyramids. However, these periods were much pointier and less large than the Egyptian ones in Giza. Taharqa was the greatest king of Kush. He ruled from 690 to 664 BC. He expanded the territory, built massive structures, including more pyramids, and had many great works created in his likeness. Statues of Taharqa are some of the most well-kept pieces of history left behind by the Kush kingdom, right alongside the pyramids. Following this, Assyrians arrived from the Middle East in troves to invade the land. They came in the mid-600s and found a lot of success pushing through North Africa. Nonetheless, Kushites were able to hold on to the land that their kingdom was in despite having to give up a lot of power and wealth. Nubian Kushites moved their influence to the city of Meroe. The city of Meroe became extremely influential through its widespread trade of iron goods. For centuries, this would be a dominant trade city that held a lot of wealth and influence. So despite the great loss to the Assyrians, Kush would still remain very prominent. Later on, Rome conquered Egypt and then subsequently made peace with the Nubian Kush kingdom. Rome's extensive trade networks facilitated interactions between Nubia and Roman politicians. Nubia was strategically located along trade routes that connected the Mediterranean world with sub-Saharan Africa. The spread of Christianity in the Roman Empire also had an impact on Nubia. Christian missionaries and traders brought the religion to Nubia. In the southern part of the region, that is today South Sudan, Christianity found an early hearth. Despite the grand achievements and resilience of the Kush kingdom, it was eventually defeated by the Aksum Empire. The Aksum Empire was based in Ethiopia and invaded the capital of the Kush kingdom. Meroe was burned to the ground and power completely shifted to Aksum. Aksum administered Nubia from afar, but had full control of the politics by working closely with Nubian politicians. Around the same time, there was Makuria. This was another Nubian kingdom that rose in the 400 CE and lasted until 1518. The kingdom of Makuria traces its origins to the collapse of the kingdom of Kush in the 4th century CE. Following the decline of Kush, several smaller Nubian kingdoms emerged, including Makuria, Nebosia, and Alodia. Makuria was Christianized in the 500 CE, likely influenced by the Byzantine Empire that had taken control of the eastern Mediterranean region, and there were many missionary efforts launched by the Coptic Christians from Egypt. Christianity became the dominant religion in Makuria, shaping its culture, society, and political institutions. Makuria's capital was located at Dongola, which was strategically situated on the Nile River. The kingdom expanded its territory southward, encompassing parts of modern-day Sudan and northern Ethiopia. Makuria's control of key trade routes and its fertile agricultural lands contributed to its prosperity and influence in the region. A major conflict was called the Second Battle of Dongola. This was a brutal conflict between the invading Arab groups and the Makuria kingdoms. The invasion occurred throughout all of 652 CE and proved the might of the Makurians. They were able to resist the massive invasion that came and handed the Arabs one of their first defeats. The peace agreement between these two powers was one of the oldest ones in the world, and it was known as Bakt. Despite this, Arabic and Islamic influence moved across Nubia at a rapid pace. The Arabs would eventually use the term Bilad al-Sudan to describe the land, meaning land of the blacks. Over the next centuries, Arabic culture spread and the use of the Arabic language became much more common. The exact date of Makuria's demise is unclear, but by the 1500s, the kingdom had been absorbed into the emerging Funj Sultanate. This sultanate controlled much of northern Sudan. The kingdom of Makuria left behind a legacy of Christianity in parts of Central Africa, mainly South Sudan. Then there was the Funj Sultanate, which rose to prominence in the 1500s under the leadership of Amara Dunkas. He founded the dynasty and established its capital at Sennar, near the confluence of the Blue and White Nile rivers. The Funj rulers adopted Islam and Arabic culture, which helped them legitimize their authority by presenting it through Allah. Under the reign of Badi III, which was from 1644 to 1681, the Funj Sultanate reached its peak, expanding its territory to include much of present-day Sudan, as well as parts of Ethiopia and Eritrea. The Fung Sultanate became a major regional power, controlling key trade routes and exerting influence over neighboring kingdoms. The Fung Sultanate was a centralized state ruled by a sultan who held absolute authority over his subjects. The Sultanate was divided into provinces, each governed by a governor appointed by the sultan. The capital city of Sennar was a center of administration, trade, and Islamic scholarship. Then there was Muhammad Ali. No, not the boxer. The Ottoman leader of Egypt. He ordered his forces to invade Sennar and the rest of the Fung Sultanate in 1820. The Ottoman-Egyptian force was able to overrun Sudan with relative ease and created the state of Turco-Egyptian Sudan. This state lasted from 1820 to 1885. The culture of Egyptians and Turks found its way to Sudan. Sudan was used mainly for its mineral and metal resources, which strengthened the Ottoman advance. The economy of Egyptian-led Sudan faltered in the 1800s because European powers wanted to end the slave trade. One of the biggest advocates of the end of the slave trade was Charles George Gordon. Gordon was a British military general that was part of the major victories in Crimea and China. He became the Governor General of Sudan in 1873 because of his relationship with Egypt. While he was Governor General, he did all he could to suppress the revolts against Egyptian rule, and he crushed local slave trade through the example he set. He made it very clear that slavery would not be tolerated and threatened military action against anyone he caught practicing it. Sir Samuel Baker was a British explorer and abolitionist that came into the region with a lot of support. He was able to become an Ottoman Pasha and Governor General in South Sudan and North Uganda. He established this region as the province of Equatoria. He also is considered the first European to visit Lake Albert, which is one of the subsidiaries of the Nile River. He was one of the biggest advocates of Britain expanding its control from Egypt to Sudan. And the reason he had so much influence is because he was supported by the British government in making whatever deals he could with the great powers that remained in the area, namely Egypt and Turkey. After Ottoman officials were accused of recruiting Christians into the Turkish administration, there was a large backlash. Great actions against this were taken by the Muslim cleric. Muhammad Ahmad believed that he was a Mahdi, which means he was a savior that, according to Muslim belief, was a sign of the end of the world. For this great title, he earned himself a large following, which he led in an invasion of Egypt. The invasion resulted in a siege of Khartoum in 1885. The siege was a successful venture, and Khartoum was successfully conquered after almost all of its defenders were slaughtered. Muhammad Ahmad eventually died of typhus fever, which sent his troops into a frenzy, and it left them very vulnerable. The British took advantage of this and launched an invasion on behalf of Egypt into the land. The leadership of Lord Kitchener was the backbone for defeating the Mahdi forces. Following this, British control was established across the Sudanese region, and Anglo-Egyptian Sudan became an official political state. Also around this time was Giuseppe Ferlini, who was an Italian soldier that was most prominent in the early 1800s. He was ordered to Sudan by the Italian government that wanted to map out a way to colonize Sudan. The Italian government wanted this because they wanted to connect Libyan territories with the Ethiopian ones. While in Sudan, Ferlini heard a legend that spoke of gold within the pyramids of Meroe. Ferlini used dynamite to blow up the top of many pyramids in Meroe, and he was actually successful because one of the pyramids had about 16 pounds of gold, which he stole. The pyramids actually still bear the marks of the explosions and have not been repaired ever since. And now we can get into British rule, which brought rapid modernization to the northern part of the country at the cost of extreme underrepresentation and corruption. Sudan was launched into the industrial age with British steel. Britain built railroads, factories, and other industrialized public creations. The north was given major education centers and British teachers. The South was left out to be ran by the unindustrialized native groups that were not given the same opportunities as the North. A huge gap between the two halves of Sudan became very clear. Britain was clearly focused on developing Khartoum and other parts of Sudan. Egypt ran south, and there was almost no development effort made. This blatant inequality between the North and South was the foundation for a major conflict. As Sudan prepared itself for independence, it became very clear that South Sudan would have almost no say in what happened in Khartoum. All of this caused the First Sudanese Civil War. The First Sudanese Civil War started in 1955 when the South Sudan rebel group known as Ennahda challenged the North in order to gain more representation in the government. At first, it was mostly protests and small uprisings, but as these movements gained more steam, the government used more military intervention to crack down on the resistance. Independence was officially achieved in 1956. Sudan was now an independent country for the first time in over 100 years. In 1958, Prime Minister Abdallah Khalil led a self-coup to oust the civilian government and enact military rule. And now, back to the Civil War. The Civil War acted as a proxy war for the Cold War because the U.S. alone sold over $1 billion in weaponry to the Sudanese forces in their hope to counter any socialism that might rise there. The stark increase in weaponry brought into Sudan caused the conflict to be far more violent and casualty heavy than it would have been had there not been such an arms trade. Another great issue with the war was the fact that there was no ethnic divisions within both sides. Another great issue with the war was the fact that there was ethnic divisions within both sides. Old tensions between different people groups within Sudan emerged in the war and caused divisions within the same unit. In 1969, there was a Sudanese coup d'etat. It was led by Colonel Ghaffari Nimeiri. The coup resulted in the incumbent government being overthrown by militaristic Muslim political factions. This was an authoritarian-style government that caused a lot of unrest in South Sudan, which was heavily Christian and non-Arabic-speaking. The second Sudanese civil war was fought from 1983 to 2005. This war was pretty much between the Muslim northern part of Sudan and the Christian south, specifically the part that became South Sudan. They fought over ideals and how to run the country, and it was also an independence war for South Sudan. During this time, a coup was started in 1985. Abdel al-Dahab, a military officer, ousted Nimeiri in hopes to bring a democratic wave. In 1989, Omar al-Bashir ousted the government and established himself as the dictatorial head of state. In 1997, the United States labeled Sudan a nation harboring terrorism because there were false allegations that a pharmaceutical factory in the capital was producing chemical weapons for al-Qaeda. In reaction to this, the United States bombed factories despite it being in the very capital of Sudan. Many innocents were killed, and it became clear in the end that this factory was not in fact an al-Qaeda supplier. And it became kind of a standard. The U.S. would do the same thing when they went to war with Saddam Hussein over quote-unquote weapons of mass destruction in his hand in 9/11, when both of which were completely false. At the same time, 20 years of harsh sanctions were placed on Sudan by the United States because it was seen as a terrorist harboring country. These sanctions crippled the economy and made it nearly impossible for Sudan to medicate its broken economic system. And, okay, so if I said it earlier, just don't keep this part, but if I didn't say it earlier, keep this part. In 1989, Omar al-Bashir ousted the government and established himself as the dictatorial head of state. That happened a little bit before the stuff with the United States, but it becomes very relevant very fast. Bashir had much military experience and was able to understand that he was just as likely as any previous leader to be ousted by a military uprising. His predictions proved him to be different, and he used a strategy called coup-proofing. The idea is that he would consistently have a band of political and military protectors that formed a small inner circle around him. However, he would make sure that other parts of the circle and the government were keeping this protection in check so that nobody would think to overthrow him. One of the most powerful arms of the Bashir government was the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF. It was the SAF that was most commonly deployed to deal with the civil uprisings in South Sudan. They were also the force that fought the civil war most consistently. The SAF was brutal, and there are many cases of its officers brutalizing accused opponents in South Sudan. While still within the civil war, a conflict in the western region of Darfur occurred. Western Sudan was less developed than the north, and because of it, there was a small population that had little to no representation in the government. Many state soldiers were occupied with the fighting in the south, so the west was primed for a rebellion. In 2003, rebel groups formed into the city of Al-Fashir. They attacked local troops to rebel against the government. In retaliation to this, al-Bashir armed local Arab militias because he didn't want to pull troops out of the conflict in South Sudan. The armed militia that was backed by the government was called the Janjaweed. The Janjaweed attacked and butchered hundreds of civilians in the Darfuri region under al-Bashir's orders. The Janjaweed are accused of leveling 3,000 villagers in the Darfur region. The SAF also faces similar allegations in this region. SAF troops were cited for inhumane violence, rape, and forced displacement of people living in the region. The success of the Janjaweed in the eyes of al-Bashir caused him to reach out for an alliance. One of Bashir's most trusted members was a Janjaweed leader named Musa Hilal. The most trusted of all was Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known in short as Hemeti, meaning my protector. He was called Hemeti as a colloquial phrase from the word Himayati, which means my protector in Arabic. By the time all was said and done, over 1 million people were killed and 4 million were displaced by the war. The long-term political instability of the nation exasperated economic struggle and caused more people to stand up against the political situation. In 2011, South Sudan gained independence. This made it the youngest country in the world and reduced Sudan from the largest country in Africa to only the third largest behind Algeria and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. On top of this, about 70% of the oil reserves that belonged to Sudan left with the independence of South Sudan. This was another huge hit to the economy and lengthened the struggle for South Sudan. The loss of South Sudan was huge for Sudan itself, but there were still major moves made by the government. Bashir, still in power in Sudan, made the Janjaweed into an official military force in 2013. The name was changed to the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The RSF and SAF were still deployed in the West because rebellious groups hadn't stopped fighting the central government. Hemedti was made a commander in the Sudanese government, which solidified his position as the protector of al-Bashir. Hemedti was given a lot of economic and militaristic freedom, and he was able to trade weapons, troops, and chemicals to local nations like Chad, Libya, and Yemen. He would do this only if those countries were willing to pay a high enough price for his goods. Hemedti was also given shares in a gold mine in West Sudan, and all of this made him filthy rich. Not only did he have money, but he also had support, so he was a very powerful man in the nation. In 2014, nearly 40% of Sudanese citizens were living at or below the poverty line. This brutal statistic highlighted the economic instability that came mostly from foreign intervention. In 2017, the United States lifted the sanctions on Sudan, but the damage had already been done. Decades of inability to change the economic standing left Sudan stuck in economic hardship that was caused by earlier colonization. Omar al-Bashir finally saw his horrendous acts catch up to him. The International Court accused him of genocide and other crimes against humanity. Despite these charges, he was able to hold power in the country all the way until 2019. Even after such a long time in power, he would still not leave it without a fight. It took a massive uprising to remove him from power. Specifically, it was the 2019 Sudanese coup d'etat. In December of 2018, the budget report for Sudan revealed that nearly 70% of the country's GDP was being forced into the security sector of the nation. This came as a great shock to the citizens of Sudan because most of them were living at or below the poverty line, while their government seemed to spend all of its money on protecting itself. Protests swept the nation by the end of December in 2018, and by early 2019, they had brewed it into something much greater. The capital city of Khartoum was swarmed by the protesters that had started a movement in many Sudanese cities. Despite the pressure, the RSF and SAF supported al-Bashir in his refusal to step down. Bashir continued to crack down on the protests, and many civilians were harmed and killed. Nonetheless, the call for change persisted, and protests for democracies did not dwindle. The people no longer supported Bashir, and this became clear to both the RSF and the SAF, who no longer saw him as valuable. On April 11, 2019, the SAF colluded with Hemedti, who represented the RSF, to stage a coup. On April 11, 2019, the SAF colluded with Hemedti, who represented the RSF, and they agreed to stage a coup. The coup actually ousted Omar al-Bashir, and this shocked both the people of Sudan and al-Bashir himself. This was a very unprecedented move because for so long they had been the arms and sword of al-Bashir. However, the military and the government did not want to leave the positions that they had held for nearly 30 years because it was very comfortable and powerful under the Bashir regime. The leader of the sentiment was Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who was a formal regional commander in the Bashir government. Abdel Fattah took power in the SAF and created a tight relationship with Hemedti of the RSF. The hopes of a democratic system were dashed rather quickly. People in the nation felt the military still had too much power, especially considering the power lied in the hands of two men that had committed horrendous acts in the civil war. Protests hit the streets in hopes to reduce military influence and encourage a fully civilian-led government. The continued abuses that happened because of the military government in Sudan caused the country to gain international attention. The U.S., the United Kingdom, the African Union, Ethiopia, and many Arab states all collaborated to put pressure on Sudan. After a lot of back and forth and resistance from the men in power across Sudan, a new system was put in place. The new system would give those of the opposition, or protesters, 6 seats in a transitional government. In contrast, there would be 5 seats for the military base for government officials. Burhan and Hemedti were both given positions in the government, to much dismay from the Sudanese people. Nonetheless, the system allowed Abdullah Hamdok to become prime minister of the nation, who was unaffiliated with both Hemedti and the RSF. The 2021 coup occurred in October of 2021. It was a secretive self-coup manufactured by Hemedti and Burhan. They wanted to oust Prime Minister Hamdok. Hamdok cracked under the pressure and resigned in early 2022. Abdel el-Burhan became the de facto leader of the country because he was the next highest ranking official in the government since he ascended to the top of the SAF. Hameti would be the second in command, and this made him the right-hand man to Burhan. However, a rivalry started to brew between Hameti and Burhan. Hameti did not like the idea of being second fiddle to anyone. So, Burhan made open and public relations with countries like China, Russia, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. But Hameti used his wealth from the gold mines and other sectors to create powerful personal alliances with leaders in these countries. Protests occurred across the nation in 2022, and foreign powers got involved once again. The US, the UK, the United Arab Emirates, and other powers forced the Sudan government to negotiate with protesters and sign an agreement. This agreement would create a transition to a civilian-led government by mid-2023. However, there is one crucial detail that caused Hameti and Burhan to come into conflict. The agreement stated that the RSF would have to merge into the SAF army of the government under Burhan. This would reduce Hameti's power in the nation. Hameti proposed that this merger could happen over the next 10 years, while Burhan wanted it to happen in no more than two. This disagreement has driven a wedge between the former allies and caused the 2023 government conflict. Both parties have deployed troops across Sudan. Ground fighting is commonplace, and Burhan has used the Sudanese Air Force to level entire areas. These airstrikes have caused thousands of casualties, and the ground fighting has forced thousands to flee out of Sudan. The rift in the government and the conflict that has followed it threatens to split Sudan into new parts once again. It seems very possible that the Darfur region in the west could attempt to break away from Sudan in the midst of all the chaos. There have been many ceasefire attempts, but one or both sides continuously break them. There is no peace in Sudan as fighting occurs across the country with no real end in sight. And with all that being said, that gets us to the present. Backlash from 60 years of conflict, including the most recent one that has happened since 2023, has left Sudan impoverished and wildly corrupt. Sudan ranks very low on the Human Development Index, despite its long history as a powerful nation. Sudan faces many issues economically, politically, and in regards to quality of life. Deep political divisions have driven violence into the public space over the last few years. Fighting is common across the nation, and it does not seem like it will be stopping anytime soon. Nonetheless, Sudan is hopeful that its luck will turn around soon because of the work being done by people within the nation. But it would be dishonest to say that the future looks bright for this very storied nation. And that gets us to the very end, where I always like to do a takeaway or a mindset, and with Sudan, it's going to be look for the light on the other side. Sudan is very much in a dark place right now. Nothing really seems to be going the way it should. There's a lot of divisions, there's violence, there's fighting, widespread poverty, politics are not stable, and there aren't great relations with the region. Two men have caused a lot of chaos in this nation, both Burhan and Hameti. But nonetheless, the Sudanese people are still in this country. They're still staying put as best they can. They're still trying to vote in elections, and many of them are taking up arms against whoever they think is the problem. And if the Sudanese people can continue to push through after decades of this struggle and back-to-back civil wars and now seemingly the brink of a third, and they can still push on, I just have to say, so can you. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. That's what the Sudanese people see. They wouldn't be doing this if there wasn't hope, or at least wasn't a deep desire to create hope. And the same thing goes to you guys. Whatever your struggle is, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and just hold out for it. No matter what your struggle is, no matter how deep it is, no matter how harsh it may go at certain times, it's going to be okay in the end. There's going to be something you can figure out. There's going to be something you can do. There's going to be a way forward. And it may not seem like it now. It may seem like it is just all black all around you. It's completely dark. There is no shining light at the end of the tunnel. But I promise it will reveal itself at some point, because if you're not dead, you just aren't at the end yet. You aren't at the solution. And nothing is going to be the end. No problem, no struggle, no breakup. None of it is going to be the end except for the actual time your life ends. So whatever you're at right now, just know that it's going to get better. It's going to get better through your effort. It's going to get better by you living your life. And it's going to get better by you trying your best to get to that better place. And at some point, there will be a light at the end of the tunnel. So you just got to hold out for it. And that gets us to the very end, where I do want to just sign off. Sudan is a very unique country. It always gets regarded less highly than Egypt because Egypt is the one that, oh, it's got the Nile River, but more of the Nile River is actually in Sudan, and there's actually more pyramids in Sudan as well. So just some facts for you guys too, just to think. Sudan is unique and culturally relevant and historically relevant, just like Egypt is. You just have to adjust your lens a little bit. But nonetheless, this was a very interesting country to study. It is sadly not in the best of places, but things can get better. Hopefully, as politics stabilize and these two men hopefully fall out of power, there can be a peace for Sudan, because the people who live here truly do love their country. And that's all you can ask for. But all that being said, I am going to sign off here and just say thank you guys so much for being here. And one more time, my name is Reese Harlinski. This is Young History. And that was Sudan. You guys have a good one.